We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
4601, or on your web, search at Mike Weaver Ballroom Dance.
It's 1 o'clock and time to jump. It's Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, here on WILL AM 580, coming to you live today, September 18th, 2011. Our guest today is someone I've wanted on the show for a very long time, one of the giant figures of Midwest journalism based up in Chicago. Celine Muwakil will be our guest today, talking about journalism and politics for the full hour. I hope you'll join us. It should be a wonderful hour. But before we go to our guest, let's go to Media Minutes.
Any views or opinions expressed by the hosts of Media Minutes are their own and do not necessarily reflect those of this station, its management, or licensee.
Welcome to Media Minutes. I'm Stevie Converse.
And I'm Candace Clement.
And I'm Megan Tatey. People around the world are communicating with video on 2 billion computers and more than 1.5 billion television sets. Surely that means our television networks, the folks who rely on video, are keeping up with the video revolution. Well, not exactly, says a recent article in the Columbia Journalism Review by veteran TV reporter David Marish. Marish's investigation found U.S. TV news is turning away from video reporting. Instead, networks are substituting arguing pundits, conversations among anchors, and so-called experts who expound on what a situation might be like from afar.
So instead of reporting from the field, you're getting discussing from the studio or the university office or anywhere but the field.
The Center for Excellence in Journalism helped Marish compile the data. While ABC, CBS, and NBC have all cut back their use of video reporting over the last 4 years, CNN's numbers are the most dramatic. In 2007, 46% of CNN's programming consisted of video packages. By 2011, it dropped to 18%.
What gets covered and how it gets covered is first and foremost these days a budgetary question, rather than a purely journalistic imperative. Now, you know, there never was a candy cane land where budgets didn't matter, but I think it's safe to say that they matter more today than they did when I got into the business, which is 50 years ago.
The move away from on-the-ground reporting is troubling, says Marish.
You got to be there to be there. You can't dial this stuff in. You can make stuff out of what you can get by dialing it in. And the networks are getting, and the cable channels are getting better and better at this. You clip some video from here and some video from there and some pieces from your file, and you put a stand-up in it, and you try your best to make sense of the story. But that's quite different from truly covering the story.
Marish worries about the endless hours of bitter, angry feuding that now gets prominent airtime in lieu of actual reporting.
I think that television news, along with radio talk, has facilitated a culture of clash and conflict rather than civility and reason. We've modeled shouting at one another. We don't model talking reasonably together.
I invite each of you to sit down in front of your own television set when your station goes on the air and stay there for a day without a book, without a magazine, without a newspaper, without a profit and loss sheet or a rating book to distract you. Keep your eyes glued to that set until the station signs off. I can assure you that what you will observe is a vast wasteland.
It's been 50 years since Newton Minow, President John F. Kennedy's Federal Communications Commission chairman, delivered his first speech to the National Association of Broadcasters. In addition to his memorable line about television, Minow issued a stern directive to the nation's broadcasters.
Gentlemen, your trust accounting with your beneficiaries is long overdue. You must provide a wider range of choices, more diversity, more alternatives. It is not enough to cater to the nation's whims. You must also serve the nation's needs.
This week, Harvard University's Berkman Center for Internet and Society revisited Minow's controversial speech and its relevance in this digital age, where technologies are creating dramatic shifts in news and entertainment. Minow, now 85, addressed the audience of Harvard professors, journalists, media critics, and other former FCC commissioners.
It's been a fundamental, basic transformation in the world of communications, and yet there have been very little thinking about what that really means.
Minow felt then, and still believes, the government's role is to expand choice. He worked to open up the UHF band for TV channels, expand cable, and shoot telecommunication satellites into space. He's remained involved with the public interest and civic responsibility since his time at the FCC. He expressed his concern about how television and money drive the political process.
Today's politics is dominated by money. Most candidates spend most of their time raising money. And why do they need the money? They need the money so they can buy radio and television time. So they're raising money from the public to get access to something the public owns, the airwaves. That's a crazy system. We're one of the few countries in the world that does not provide public service time candidates.
You've been listening to Media Minutes, a production of Free Press, a national nonpartisan organization working to reform the media. For more information, visit freepress.net.
Okie dokie, welcome back to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, here in WILL AM 580, coming to you live today, September 18th, 2011. Our guest today is someone I've wanted to have on the show, I think, since we began 9.5 years ago. And for a variety of reasons, it's never quite panned out. But fortunately, thanks to the hard labor of our producer, we have as our guest today Salim Muwakkil, who is the senior editor of In These Times, where he's worked since 1983. He's also the host of the Salim Muwakkil Show on WVON, Chicago's historic black radio station. And he is someone anyone living in Chicago is well familiar with as a journalist who's written for both the Chicago Sun-Times, the Chicago Tribune. During the course of the show, I'll throw out tidbits of his impressive resume. But rather than do that now, let's talk to our guest, Salim Muwakkil. Welcome to Media Matters.
Oh, thank you for having me, Bob. It's really a pleasure to be with you, man.
Well, yeah, and there's so much I want to talk with you about, Salim, and I suspect our listeners like to hear from you. But before we get into politics and journalism, a little bit about the two main media that are associated with you. First, In These Times, for listeners who might not be familiar with In These Times, you know, you've been connected to it now for nearly three decades. Yes, exactly. So tell folks what it is and what you do for In These Times.
Well, In These Times is, I guess you would say, a non-sectarian, left-leaning journal of news and culture that is now monthly. It started out as a weekly, and at one point it was a bi-weekly, and now it's a monthly. It's a smaller format than it used to be, but it basically deals with left. It deals with events in the world from a left perspective, and it is. Noted for its penetrating reports and its wide ranging spectrum of interests. You know, a cultural interest deals with a lot of music and art and other kinds of issues that you wouldn't, you wouldn't normally find in such a small journal. And we've been around for as you say, a little bit more than three decades, and we are still pushing strong.
And then, of course, you still have, how long have you been doing the show on WVON?
Well, this is actually my second incarnation on the radio station. When it was on 1450, that's when it had a limited signal. I was doing a Sunday show, kind of a news talk show, in the 90s, early 90s, early to mid-90s, and I've been doing it this time around since 2007, in which I do a Saturday show, and now I'm doing weekdays as well. I'm doing Wednesdays and Thursdays as well.
Now, VON, as I recall, stands for Voice of the Negro. Is that right?
That was its original designation.
Now we
say the Voice of the Nation.
Okay. Well, I'm a historian. I go back to the original designation.
Yes, indeed. That's how it got its start and gained its fame, actually.
That's right. And it's historically been one of the very few African-American-owned, operated radio stations in the United States. And it regrettably still has that distinction, if I'm not mistaken.
It does, indeed. And, in fact, it's the only black-owned station in Chicago.
And, you know, this is an issue that we've talked about a little bit on this program in the past, but while we're on it right now, it's worth going back to, which is, you know, radio is such an important medium in the United States, especially in urban areas where people are in cars a lot and hear radio a lot. And, you know, what we've seen in the United States in the past 10 or 15 years is, bizarrely enough, a huge drop-off in the number of minority station owners.
Yeah, that is a growing concern within the community because many political victories have been attributed to the push that was given by radio support. In Chicago, for example, Harold Washington's election was abetted strongly by WVON and other stations at the time that were black oriented, but. As black ownership disappears, that kind of venue is also disappearing, and everything is being kind of absorbed in this corporate reach. People are much less concerned with news, and the news bite is becoming smaller and smaller. And when it does show up, it's more concerned with pop culture than it is with other kinds of news issues. And so it's a dire situation, really, in terms of information for much of the black community. That's why stations like WVON, which focuses primarily on hard news and discussion of hard news, that's why they're so important.
Well, conversely, the other side of that coin is that if one drives around America, as I do a lot of, behind the wheel, and I listen to a lot of AM radio, one of the really striking developments is that wherever you are in the country, there seem to be several stations with extreme right-wing talking talk shows on the air. That's very rare that I've ever been in a situation where I couldn't find at least one. And oftentimes it's two or three. And sometimes it's the same person. You'll just hear Rush Limbaugh on three different channels saying it.
Right.
I mean, but that's also an enormous change, too, because 25 years ago.
Tell me this, Bob. You tell me, man. Why is, there's been all kind of theories put forth that, the right wing is so declarative and that makes them more mediagenic. Well, how do you explain the popularity of right-wing talk?
Okay, listeners, now you know we have a journalist as my guest because he's turned it around and he's asking the questions. Oh, Salim, it's my show. You answer the questions, man. No, okay, that's a complex issue, not to take a cop-out, but, there are a number of factors that play into that. Mm-hmm. And but I think that's part of it. I mean, I think, having a sort of a very simplistic, easy-to-digest message with good guys and bad guys, it lends itself well to, apparently, to sort of radio. But I think there's other factors as well, not the least of which is the one you started with, which is that, the interests of the owners and the advertisers are much more comfortable with that sort of message than they might be with what WVON's doing. And even if you have a large audience, it just doesn't, there's a much less wiggle room for you or for WVON than there is apparently for someone, who's spewing out, let's lower the taxes on wealthy people as their main thing.
Yeah, right. Good point. Yeah. Well, I mean, that's one of the things, that's one of the issues that WVON has to deal with. Because for one thing now, we are the only African-American-owned station in the city, and we focus on a lot of issues that are important to African-Americans. So we are often pressured to include the views of right-wing African Americans, of whom there are a few as well, unfortunately.
And that's really a good career decision, isn't it? Seems like if you're a right-wing African American, you can like write
absolutely.
Your ticket.
I'm telling you that if I was if I was just entering the market these days, I would think heavily about being the black Rush Limbaugh if I could possibly swing it.
If you can look yourself in the mirror.
Yes, indeed. I'm sure that. The embellishments around the mirror would help things quite a bit. But yeah. That's really a difficult and vexing thing to deal with. And it's how do we appear to be fair, ideologically fair, when quite frankly, there is no real sense of that. That's why it's so incredible that the Tea Party is what it is. We have these people who are absolutely struggling against their own best interests, and it seems so absurd, it seems similarly absurd to try to wedge right wing black thought into a station like WVON. But there's a lot of pressure to do things like that.
Our guest today, Salim Muwakkil, joining us on the phone lines from his home, I assume, in Chicago. This is a live show of Media Matters and WILL. The phone lines are open. We welcome your callers. The line here, of course, is 333-9455, and we have a toll-free line at 1-800-222-9455. Please call in and join us. Salim, you have been following Chicago politics a long time. You've been in the city, I think, since the 70s or early 80s.
Got here in the 70s.
In the 70s, you finished up at Rutgers and headed to the heartland.
Well, actually, I worked in Newark, New Jersey for a while with the Associated Press.
Okay.
And I came here after that experience.
And you have been covering Chicago politics, and I want to talk later in the show about Harold Washington, someone who regrettably has gotten lost to some extent in America's historical amnesia, and who you're familiar with, of course, and know a lot about. But before we get to Harold Washington, I'd like to start with a more recent Chicago politician. Mm-hmm. Who everyone knows about, Barack Obama. Mm-hmm. And you've been aware of Obama long before he became a national figure. He was a player in Chicago. And I just, I'd be very interested just to hear your take on the guy and then, move forward to your take on him as president.
Well, I met him before he became a politician, in fact. I met him when he was an attorney with a public interest law firm here, Judson Minor's law firm in Chicago. Judson Minor later became the corporation counsel of Harold Washington, the first one. But Judd was his employer, and he wanted to introduce this new hotshot lawyer to the activist community in Chicago, and so he introduced him. He introduced him to me, and we had a long talk in his office one day. And the thing that impressed me most about Barack Obama was his knowledge of the black movement, and I mean the esoterica of the black movement. Things like who was Martin Delaney versus Frederick Douglass. Most people don't have that kind of deep knowledge of the movement. He did, and he was aware of the ideological streams. We talked about nationalism versus the kind of vigorous integrationist strains in the movement, and so he revealed himself as very knowledgeable about what's going on in the black community. I later learned that much of that, he intentionally buttressed himself up to become, he began to wear the African-American label. It didn't come natural to him. So he was kind of boning up on the cultural aspects and the historical aspects of the identity. But he wore it well, and he seemed to be a very progressive well-spoken activist. He said that's how I first perceived him. And when he began to run for politics, I was, very happy that he wanted to throw his hat in the ring. And his pedigree, his initial pedigree, was under a legislator named Alice Palmer, who is the wife of a guy named Buzz Palmer, a very, very esteemed progressive family in Black Chicago. And she kind of took him under her wing at first, and so that gave him, you know, a very positive send-off. Eventually, they had some tensions between them, but he sought it out with a good foot, and I was on his side. I also understood, though, that he rubbed some people the wrong way. His first political forays were against Bobby Rush, who had really established himself in the Black community and had a strong nationalist constituency. Chicago is very known for its Black nationalist constituency. It's one of the few cities left in this country that has such a strong Black nationalist component. Black nationalists were a very strong component of the Harold Washington group. And so he lost to Bobby Rush, and he provoked some divisions within the community between those who had a nationalist perspective and those who had a more integrationalist perspective. He was seen as someone enthralled to the University of Chicago and that intellectual cadre. And a lot of people dismissed him at first. And then he ran for Senate, for state Senate, and he began to mend some fences with the Black community. And eventually he won the community over with his, because he championed a lot of issues that were considered important to people in the community. And so he became, he became a pretty well-respected politician as a senator. And Emil Griffith Jones. Wow, Emil Griffith. Wow, that's a boxer,
from
way back.
I remember him.
Where that came from. Emil Jones took him under his wing, and Emil Jones was the Senate president, a Black man who had a lengthy tenure in the legislature in Illinois and was well known as a wheeler and dealer. He took Barack under his wing and ushered him into the legislature with some advantages. He steered legislation his way. He made sure that Obama's name was on some signature bills, and he made a pretty good name for himself in the Illinois legislature as a pretty progressive element. He championed some pretty progressive legislation.
So at this point, you're feeling, your response to him was fairly positive.
Yeah, pretty much so. You know, I understand his limitations, and I realize that he has a certain style that is different from what we may have been used to from Chicago Black politicians, and that's cool because he brings a level of sophistication that really had been missing, quite frankly, from the Chicago school. And so when he ran, I was a bit surprised when people embraced him so fulsomely after his speech during the Democratic convention. I said, wow, I mean, he just did it. You know, he made a nice speech. But right after that, people start touting him for the next president. I said, wow, you're talking about premature. I thought that was exceedingly premature. And I didn't know if he was ready yet. I knew he was a quick study and a very, very intelligent intelligent guy and ambitious as well. But he kept his ambitions pretty well shielded, you know, pretty veiled. He didn't seem to be a grasping kind of guy. He was just kind of laid back, letting things happen. But he had confidence. He projected this aura of confidence. And so I was all for him entering the race after it became clear that he was going to do it. I thought he would bring a freshness, pretty much what he campaigned as, a fresh new element of change. Mm-hmm. And so that was my expectation. But I began to sense early in his campaign that he was becoming a little bit too calibrated. David Axelrod was deeply involved in his campaign, and David Axelrod has a pretty good history. I mean, he's been involved in some very important political races in Illinois and in Chicago, and he was responsible in large part for Harold Washington's mastery, as such as it was, of the media. Mm-hmm. And Harold Washington's attempt to craft a multiracial campaign, you know. And so Axelrod was familiar with the terrain, and he managed Barack Obama's campaign in that way. And I began to sense, though, that Axelrod is also very attuned to the political center. He knows where that center is when others don't seem to know. And I began to see the president or the candidate track in that way, and he began to desert some of his long-held passions, his progressive passions, the issues that he spoke for in the past. And so I began to worry a little bit that he was becoming a little bit too calculated.
And now we've had to jump ahead a little bit, Salim Muakil. We've had almost 2.5 years, roughly, pushing our third year now of President Obama and the Obama administration. Have you been surprised, disappointed? What's been your response to his administration and his policies?
Well, I've been a bit disappointed. I wasn't that surprised. I mean, I knew his style of leadership, and I knew he wouldn't be a raving kind of guy. I knew he was always conciliatory in temperament, but I thought he was a much more astute chess player than he turns out to be. Although, you know, the game is not over, right? He still may be. I mean, he fooled me once before. As I say, during the campaign, I became critical of his, of what seemed to be his rightward trajectory. Mm-hmm. And it turns out that was the right move at that point. He won the election, and so I was chastised a bit by my own inability to see where the compass pointed. So I'm still reluctant to make any kind of overall judgment, but I've been disappointed with his lack of aggressiveness. He doesn't use the bully pulpit as I think he could, And I'm more than that. I'm disappointed in those who protect him so much that they resist putting progressive ideas out there in the political discourse. Mm-hmm. So the right wing has completely monopolized the discourse. We think in right wing assumptions now.
You know, there's been a bit of controversy, Salim Muakil, in the last couple months when Tavis Smiley and Cornel West went on their poverty tour, which had a distinct element of criticism of the Obama administration for not really coming through on crucial areas for poor people in general and African-American people specifically. What was your take on that tour and that debate?
I like what Tavis and Cornell do. I'm not a fan, a stylistic fan of Tavis Smiley. I like Cornel West. I mean, I liked him when he was a bit more rigorous, though. I think he's a bit too maybe grandiloquent is the word. He's playing himself a little bit. He's caricaturing himself a little bit too much, I think. Mm-hmm. But I still welcome his perspective, and I think he's on target with that. I mean, I think his name calling detracted from his message a bit, and it provided those who want to support the president no matter what, it provided them with ammunition to dismiss his criticisms. And I think his criticisms were very, very important and should be considered as we look at our communities, which are suffering relentlessly and disproportionately. And there needs to be some disproportionate attention brought to it. And I think that's the point that Tavis and Cornell are making. And I think that, again, I've been, you know, this has been a clinic for me in many ways, Bob, because the black community loves this guy so much. It loves President Obama so much. It wants him to be successful so badly because, you know, he's the first African-American president, and they don't want him to be a failing president. And so that enables him to get away with so much in our community. And it's so ironic that we have a black president who really can't say anything about black issues.
Yeah. Our guest today, Salim Muwakkil, who you've just been listening to, he is the senior editor of In These Times, the host of a program on WVON, a daily show now, you tell me.
Well, Wednesdays and Thursdays every week.
Wednesdays and Thursdays. Saturday nights also still?
Saturdays as well, yes, sir.
Saturday and WVON in Chicago. And has won numerous awards. I could go through the list. It's quite impressive. But trust me, you can Google his name and read to your heart's content an extraordinary career in journalism, including writing for both the two daily newspapers of Chicago, the Sun-Times and the Tribune, over the years. The phone line here is 333-9455, our toll-free number, 1-800-222-9455. We have someone who's been waiting very patiently. I hope they're still with us. Let's try line one. You're on the air with Salim Muwakkil.
Yes. Very interesting discussion. I appreciate your remarks. One of the things that troubles me about Obama is that he, for some reason or other, he just doesn't want to put on the boxing gloves and, or, as you put it, get up on the bully pulpit. Now, back in 46, when they told Truman he could never get elected in 48 and that he had a Republican Congress, he right away went after the Republican Congress. Every single time that he mentioned them, he called them the good-for-nothing 80th Congress. Not just once or twice, but every single time.
Right.
Now, why does not Barack Obama put on the boxing gloves and say, for example, you know, the Republican Party wants jobs, yes, in China. And why does he not say, when he refers to the Tea Party, that the anti-government Tea Party sickos or something like that? Every single time he's got the bully pulpit, he could do it. He could get up there and he could say the anti-government Tea Party sickos or yokels. If you want, because that's basically what the Tea Party is. They're people from the hookworm and Bible Belt. Why doesn't
hookworm
he get up
and Bible
there
Belt?
And
wow.
Why doesn't he
you
get
know,
up
it,
and say?
It reminds me of a comment that Christopher Hitchens made: "All politics is a yokel."
Well, in other words, I think you seem to have that same worry, maybe not to the same degree, but I wonder what your comment is.
Well, thank you very much, caller. Salim, go right ahead.
Yes, I certainly agree. I think he should utilize that bully pulpit. And he's been saying pass my bill and repeating that so frequently that might be his version of what Truman did. And, you know, unfortunately, I don't know who's listening to that. Even the Democrats seem to be a bit reluctant to fulsomely support his jobs bill. You know, I agree. I mean, I think he should clearly delineate the differences between the Democratic Party's interests and the Tea Party-influenced Republicans' interests. I think that would go a long way toward clarifying where the public wants to go, because I think most people are with him. Most people understand how obdurate and obstructionist the Republicans have become. And they just need some reinforcement for that, and he could do it.
Salim, before we go back to the phone lines, I want to ask you about some of the columns you've written that I think are most instructive, which deal with the sort of police relations with the African-American community. You usually write about Chicago, but I think these are national issues. Mm-hmm. And I think they're issues that for white Americans, especially middle-class white Americans, who have a very different relationship with the police than African-Americans. These are very abstract issues. And aside from you, and there was Bob Herbert who would write about this in the New York Times when he's a columnist, it gets, I would say, virtually no coverage whatsoever in what's considered the mainstream media. And,
that's
you
really
know,
a shame.
But you do cover it. And so, I mean, what are some of the key points you try to write about to get out in the public eye that you think aren't being covered with regard to police African-American relations in America's cities?
Well, some of it is beginning to sneak out. Thanks in large part to that great book by Michelle Alexander.
Yeah, she was a guest on the show, by the way, and I was going to ask you about that extraordinary book.
That's an extraordinary book, and that sister has really sparked a fire that needed to be ignited, because that is indeed, I think, the crisis of our period, this incredible incarceration epidemic that we're undergoing, and how racially disproportionate it is. There are communities in Chicago, for example, Bob, that are basically completely wiped out of black men, of men with agency, of any kind of commercial activity. The underground economy is basically the only kind of commercial vitality that these young people who are growing up there see. All of their hopes, many of their prospects for esteem, for community esteem, and all of those ancillary issues are tied up with underground, with success in the underground economy. So much of the culture is oriented in that direction. Much of it is jail based, even the styles, the clothing styles, basically are jail based. A lot of the music, and so. It's a dire situation that is cycling upon itself in a very negative way, and much of the reason for it is this heavy incarceration focus from the police department and the criminal justice system and the drug war. Drug war is what's doing it, really.
Mm-hmm.
And as Michelle points out, and it's so. I think when we look back on this period of time, We'll look back like we do now when lynching used to be so common, and we'll say to ourselves, how could we possibly have allowed that to go on under our watch? I mean, all we have to do is look at the population of our jails, and we can see just how wildly disproportionate they are racially. Marijuana, for example, one of the points that I raised in this piece that I did on the police relationships with the community is marijuana arrests. Well, we all know that. Just about everybody smokes some weed now and then, but about 85% of those arrested for it in Chicago are black, black men, and that's there's really no other way to explain that but to point to the racial disparities there, and that there must be some attitude. There must be some bias somewhere along the line that we're not dealing with, and we have to deal with that much more aggressively. So that's what I try to point out quite a bit in my pieces with the police, and the police are seen by most young black people as an occupying army. It's been that way for a long time. It's been that way at least since I was growing up. I remember the police used to just to humiliate us, man, gratuitously. We would be singing a lot, during the time when I was growing up, doo-wops were the big thing. So we'd be in the hallway where we had an echo chamber. The police would bust in on us sometimes, and just to show that they were in charge, they would make us pull our pants down and those kinds of things. And we got used to it, but we never looked at the police as a helpful part of our community. We never met Officer Friendly. And I don't think Officer Friendly is still too prominent in the black community.
Our guest today, Salim Muwakkil, who's joining us from Chicago. He's a senior editor of In These Times, where he's worked since 1983, and he's also a host of the Salim Muwakkil Show on WVON, Wednesdays and Thursdays, and also Saturday night. It's a pleasure to have him here. It's a live show, so the phone lines are open at 333-9455, or our toll-free number, 1-800-222-9455. We have another caller who's been waiting very patiently. Let's go to line 2, Champaign County. You're on the air.
Hi. I'd like to have you talk to us about Chicago a bit and two different things. One of them is the school, the battle about the schools. Arne Duncan, is a turnaround capitalist artist, venture capitalist. He uses the same language, has no credentials in education except his mother was a teacher, which I have too. And it's just amazing the kind of things that are going on up there with the disruption of the communities, through these school changes, the fact that it's gone, I think the accurate figure is that they've gone from 3 high school military academies to 10 or 11 in his term, and, you know, when he was school head. And the other thing is about Hollywood Rick. There's that story that people don't seem to remember about the near fist fight on the state Senate floor between Obama and he, and it seemed like Obama was the belligerent one, actually, contrary to being cool. And but he's disappeared. I don't know whether he got into a scandal that was actual, or it seems to me that he was a marked man in the sense that, particularly with Rahm Emanuel in there, he's known for settling scores and finding ways to get people out. I don't know if that's too conspiratorial or what's really going on with that. I just, you know, it's amazing how little discussed some of this is. And when I bring it up sometimes, well, people, they know about it, but they don't actually. I find people don't even know about how the sex scandal that brought Alan Keyes out here, the carpet-bagging Republican. People just don't seem to have any political memory, or why do I remember this?
Well, because you listen to the show, obviously. Thank you, caller, for calling. And let's start with the Chicago School, Salim. And let me just add one thing to that question, because I teach at the University of Illinois.
Okay.
I've taught here for 12 years now. Mm-hmm. And it never ceases to amaze me that my classrooms are filled with students from the suburbs of Chicago. But it's extremely rare that I get a student who's come to the Chicago public schools. Mm. I mean, I probably could count them on one hand. Now, sometimes I have large classes, so I don't know the high school of every kid. But I get the background of any time I have a class under 30, I learn who the students are and their backgrounds, where they're from, and the high schools they went to. And it's just astonishing to me that you know, it's such a sharp distinction. I probably have more students from Naperville than from Chicago. Mm-hmm. In fact, I do. I definitely do. Probably by a factor of 10 to 1.
Wow.
And, you know, so, I hear these stories about Chicago public schools from kids from Chicago, too, that are not very positive. And, you know, so anything you can inform us would be appreciated.
Well, yeah, the educational level of graduates is pretty low, because Chicago schools are not doing what they should be doing. And there are all kinds of problems in administration, and one of the things that you have to credit the new mayor with, although some are not crediting him with it, but he's focusing on the school system in a way that hadn't been focused on in the past. There's a lot of waste, a lot of old time patronage that's still going on in the administration, and a lot of teachers are not doing what they should be doing to accommodate new in the changing social situations. But of course, all of it comes down to the economics of the city, the fact that the city is increasingly poor, and these poor areas are increasingly isolated. And in an attempt to attract middle-class residents back to the city, the previous mayor attempted, to make some schools magnet schools and more attractive to middle class residents, and by doing that, he scrimped on schools that were, may have just been getting by, and they no longer can get the kind of resources that were necessary, and so they have been deemed failing schools, and they've been closed. And so a lot of student populations from one school has been transferred to another school. And this is happening at the same time that the so-called plan for transformation is happening in public housing, and with so many housing units are being destroyed and not being replaced in any kind of, commensurate manner. And so the populations are displaced. Many populations are moving to new communities. I know you heard about this case where a young student named Darian Albert was killed by some students at another school. Well, that's the product of what they call Renaissance 2010, where they consolidated the student body of one school into another school. And so there were all of these social pressures and tensions between students from different areas of the city, these kind of turf antagonisms, And that was the reason for that fighting, for those fights. And those fights had been going on for quite a while. They just culminated with this tragic death of this student that was videotaped around the world. But so there are all of these political and social tensions that impinge on the scholastic integrity of the school system, and that's causing problems with learning, and it's like much that's going on in the city, it's a handful that has to be seriously addressed, and I think those are some of the massive problems that are being attacked by the new mayor.
Now, how about Ernie Duncan? Do you have any insight on him from his Chicago days?
Well, he began that process. He was in league with the mayor to make as many of the schools as attractive to new middle class residents as possible, and so it was him who instituted these policies of failing schools, closing failing schools, this notion of testing students teaching students to these tests and whatnot. Although he would make occasional statements, because this was a time when Bush's No Child Left Behind thing was so strong, and there was a lot of criticism about that because it seemed to be orienting instruction toward these tests, and he was in opposition of that. He has, in fact, instituted very similar programs himself, and his legacy of Renaissance 2010 is still what a lot of activists, educational activists, are railing against right now. They're saying that he poisoned the water, and until we get the influence of Arne Duncan out of the Chicago school system, there can really be no serious improvement. So that's one of the battles now going on, as a matter of fact.
Well, Salim, if I can ask you about the second half of the question, I'm unaware of Hollywood Rick.
That may be a bit too esoteric. Hollywood Rick is Ricky Hendon. He was a senator, a state senator. They call him Hollywood Rick because he was a pretty flamboyant guy from the west side of Chicago. He was a pretty uncompromising legislator in terms of his championing issues that were important to the black community, but he was also a little bit too ostentatious, and he resigned from the Senate. I think he's having some tax problems right now, but he did run afoul of the Democratic machine in Chicago, the Daily Machine. He was often a foe of that machine, but he was pretty much a neutral element when Emmanuel came in. I think that his problems were rooted elsewhere.
You know, before we go to our last caller, Salim Muwakkil, our next caller, I do want to have you talk a little bit about Harold Washington, and for many of our listeners who may never have even heard of him, our younger listeners, or mm-hmm. for listeners outside of the Midwest, we have a national and international audience who don't really know the history of Chicago politics that well. Mm-hmm. Maybe a little background for people who really are starting pretty much with a blank slate about who he was and his importance historically.
Well, Harold Washington was a Chicago native, deeply rooted here, a well-schooled in the nuts and bolts of Chicago politics. He became a state legislator early in his career. First, he worked for Ralph Metcalf, who was a congressman. He himself was a state legislator. He became a congressman. Ralph Metcalf, incidentally, was Jesse Owens' running partner in the Olympics in which they embarrassed Hitler.
1936 in Berlin, of course.
Absolutely. And he came home and he became a politician, and Harold was his campaign manager. And then he became, Harold Washington became himself a state legislator. And after a while, and during his tenure, he was highly regarded as a very disciplined politician who was principled, knew the game very well, very eloquent. He was known for his eloquence, and he rose to prominence when right after Mayor Daley died. There was I can't quite remember his name, but he was supposed to take over the ceremonial duties after the mayor died. Mm-hmm. It was his position in the city council, and he was a black guy, and there was so much racism in the city that they refused to even let him take over those ceremonial mm-hmm. duties. And so Harold Washington led a campaign to voiced the concern of the black legislators and other black elected officials that he was this his name will probably pop into my mind pretty soon, but that he was being disrespected in that activity and in his actions on behalf of this the city council member. He gained some prominence, and a lot of people began to look at him as an important leader in the black community. That was when I first became attracted to him, because at the time he used a word that I could not imagine a black politician using in Chicago, and that was Kafkaesque. He said he found himself in a Kafkaesque situation. I said, oh wow, a politician who has read Kafka, that's a rare thing in Chicago. And so I was interested in him from that point on. He didn't fail to disappoint me. Not only with his range of knowledge and scholarship, but also his political acumen. You know, he became a very, very important figure in the post-Daley era in Chicago. In fact, he even ran for mayor earlier against Belandic when Belandic ran, when Jane Byrne ran.
Yeah, 1979.
Right. And he lost. He didn't do that well. But he made a good showing, and he impressed more people. And then he ran for Congress in 80. He won at the legendary first congressional district, which was the district that also Oscar DePriest and. Who was the first legislator after Reconstruction from the North, and he was during the Reagan administration. He became really the spokesman for the urban agenda. He was so eloquent, and he was so pointed in his criticism of the Reagan administration. He was effective in that. And he was often on the McNeil-Lehrer report. Where they, you know, did extended interviews. He wasn't like a shouter. He had some substance to his critique. And so after a while, it became apparent that there was a vacuum in the mayor's seat. Jane Byrne had run, and she had become the mayor, and she was elected on the strength of a lot of black support. But a lot of black people became disappointed with her because she began to go back on her word and enact policies that were injurious to the black community. And so people began looking for a black candidate. Harold Washington's name became much more prominent. He was a little bit reluctant to get into the fray because he was really having a ball in Congress. He was, mm-hmm. he was, you know, in his element. But he was persuaded to come back. A lot of people wanted him to come back. And he did. He had some demands that people do some serious vote registration and raise some serious funds in order for him to run. They did that. He came back. He inspired a campaign that was basically a campaign and a crusade at the same time. Became extremely popular. He became a popular politician. Virtually every black voter was in his column. And it became a movement, the Harold Washington movement. He was the first black mayor of the city. He was very ecumenical in his appeal. He reached out to the Latino community really for the first time in any serious way. And he cultivated a lot of Latino support. He reached out to white progressives, and he attracted their attention because he had a very progressive program. He was talking about kind of a you know, a black nationalist tinted campaign, but it also had very, very progressive elements, reform elements that was attracted to those reform forces within Chicago. And so he attracted a coalition that was very rare in the city, and then they ignited kind of a progressive prairie fire.
I wish we'd started earlier in this, because I could listen to you talk about Harold Washington forever, and I know you wrote the text to the book, Harold, Photographs from the Harold Washington Years. But just to, I mean, the tragedy, of course, is that he wasn't able to finish his first term. He died of a heart attack, if I'm not mistaken.
Yes, sir. That's the tragedy.
And he probably would have been reelected, wouldn't he, had he?
He did. He was reelected.
Well, he was reelected.
Yeah, he died right after his reelection.
That's right.
Yeah, yeah. He died right after his reelection.
So that answers that question.
But I think he would have been reelected again. I mean, I think he was on the way. He said he was going to be the mayor for 20 years. I think he was on the way to that. He began to attract a lot of respect in many communities.
That's absolutely the case. Let's go to a final caller, if that caller is still with us, and they may not be after all this, and I apologize. Line 1, Savoy, you're on the air with Salim Muwakkil.
Yeah, I'm calling about a great supporter, as well as myself, of Harold Washington, and that was Nate Clay. He used to be the only black progressive on WLS. He had that late-night radio station, and all of a sudden he just dropped off. And I wondered what happened to him. Is he still living?
Nate Clay is still around. He's very active in organizing trips to Africa and other parts of the African diaspora. He's a very, very active commentator. He was deeply involved in the Carol Moseley Braun campaign, a faded campaign, I might add.
But I mean, the mayoral race this year.
Right, the mayoral race this year. So Nate Clay is still around. Thank you for asking. He was indeed the most progressive thing on WLS.
Thank you very much, caller. You know, we've only got a couple minutes left, Salim Muwakkil, and I'd like to get your take. Yeah, you're a few years older than I am, but we're roughly the same era. And as we get older and older, the distinctions fade, as you
That's
know.
That's right.
And, you know, you've seen America from, you know, you came of age in the 60s, and you were in the Air Force for 5 years, then went to college. I mean, you come from a fairly standard American tradition. I think you shared a lot of experiences, but you've also been politically engaged your adult life. You know, how do you see this country? How has it changed? If you had to generalize, you had to talk. Someone came here from another country and asked you how it's changed in your lifetime, for better, for worse, and looking forward. Well, how would you respond?
Wow, that's really, really such a difficult question, Bob, because there's so many various and countervailing trends. Mm-hmm. On the one hand, there's been some progressive change. I've seen some very progressive things happen. I think people are much more enlightened when it comes to gender relationships. Even race relationships are not as bad as they were when I was growing up. I mean, you know, I've seen the colored bathrooms and that kind of thing traveling through the South. So I've seen that kind of stark apartheid. But on the other hand, I've seen some distressing changes in our kind of cultural attitude. We seem to be much more willing to embrace anti-intellectualism. We've lost our affection for cutting edge philosophy and spiritual adventurism. There's a distressing retraction, I think, of our consciousness in some ways. But at the same time, I sense a new kind of spirit going on in the world as well. It's not associated with politics. I mean, we wait for this new progressive wave to come upon us after the end of socialism. It seems like capitalism has won the race, and it's burying itself into our consciousness in very nefarious ways. But I think there's another spirit. There's another sensibility that's on the verge of becoming apparent. I don't know quite what it is.
And unfortunately, Salim, I think we have to leave it at that point. But that's actually a very nice note to end on.
Yes, sir.
The band's tuning up in the background. They need me out of the studio. Salim Muwakkil, thank you so much for taking time from your Sunday to join us today.
Hey, thank you, brothers. It's been a pleasure, Bob.
And let's do it again someday. I want to thank Kyle Kroha, my engineer, Melissa Trentz, my producer, for the great work. I'm Bob McChesney. Thank you all for listening. We'll be back in 167 hours. Take care.
Today's broadcast is made possible with support from Mike Weaver Ballroom Dance. Private instruction for social or competitive dancing, weddings, or other special events. Lessons for singles or couples, beginners or advanced of all ages. Information at 378-4601 or on your web, search at Mike Weaver Ballroom Dance.
This is Illinois Public Media, WILL AM 580 and 90.9 FM, HD3, Urbana. Cloudy skies have blanketed much of the region today. We'll see a high near 75. Showers and thunderstorms are likely this afternoon, and they'll continue this evening. Monday, a chance of showers and thunderstorms, cloudy, then gradually becoming mostly